Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hi, folks. I'm Jalene Fenner, and welcome to Strong Tower Radio with my co-host,
Tom Bajur.
And Tom, this is your favorite program. We aired the Garden Guy.
That's right. We're not supposed to have favorites, but it applies to me more than some subjects. So it is. I enjoy it greatly.
Yes, because Tom is becoming not just a gardener, but maybe a
farmer.
Yeah.
I got my license. I got a doing business as, so I'm official now. So.
And our garden guy is Gary Heilig. Hi, Gary.
Hello. You never asked me what my favorite program was.
Well, what is your favorite program?
Bible Answers Live.
Oh, and that is almost everybody's favorite. Thank you for bringing that up.
That is our number one program that people like. But, you know, since we've been airing The Garden Guy, we've been telling people to give us a call.
You did a PSA for that, yes, a public service announcement.
Questions. And so we do have some questions. So before we even get into our program, we're going to do these questions. But first, Tom, let's have a word of prayer.
Absolutely. Our Father in heaven, you just smile upon us. Lord, there was a garden, and it was in Eden, and you walked with Adam and Eve. And Lord, one day you're going to walk with us in a garden in heaven. And boy, it will be wonderful to have the master gardener at our side. But until then, we're going to be studying something that you gave us in the Garden of Eden to sustain us, to bring us joy, to bring us happiness. Be with us in this conversation and help there be something that every listener will take away and feel closer to God. In Jesus' name. Amen.
Okay, so Tom, we've had some questions have come into the studio to ask Gary. So.
Absolutely, and keep them coming. This question came from Pastor Wes Peppers. He happened to be in our studio, and he asked this directly to Gary earlier today, a real pertinent question, and that is his cucumbers are bitter. And he wants to know how to prevent it, or either this year or to do better next year.
Well, there's not a whole lot he can do this year, but there are a couple of reasons why they might be bitter. One, you can get a bacterial disease that can do that.
So how do you prevent that bacteria?
Well, the bacteria is prevented from getting into the plant by controlling the insects that carry the bacteria.
Okay, insect control.
That's right. And that's not hard to do at all. There are lots of insecticides that'll control the cucumber beetles. The other thing is if they haven't been watered on a regular basis, he can get some bitterness that way.
So it's insect control with both either traditional chemical or to organic chemicals. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then repeating, I'm sounding like a cooking show here. In fact, we're looking at doing a program with Mark Anthony.
Yes,
we're recording
that's right.
that this week to be aired later. And the other one is water. Now, you were telling, adding that sometimes we go on vacation and sometimes that's when the garden collapses.
Yeah, and sometimes you may have to have a garden sitter if you're going to be away
garden
for a
sitter.
While.
I've heard of babysitter.
Yeah. Well, people that have indoor plants, they have to be taken care of too. So you have to get somebody that knows what they're doing that will come over and check on your plants.
So part of your vacation plans is getting a garden sitter or a plant sitter.
Or you can install your own irrigation system with a timer.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Now, the second question came from Bob. He texted it into me, and you can email those into us. And his question is that proper care for 2 and 3 year old apple trees. What do we need to do? And then he has a follow up question.
Well, when you have trees that are that young, the major thing that you're trying to do is establish the framework as you're training the trees. In the case of pruning the tree, there's not much to do other than...
It hasn't grown that much yet.
Yeah, just the establishment pruning and taking off dead material. You don't normally spray them on a regular basis like you would a tree that's producing, but you do need to watch the tree so that sometimes you may get something like a tent caterpillar or something that's going to consume leaves, and you have to deal with those. But other than that, make sure it's well watered so that it gets really well established.
Consistent.
Fertilize it in the spring.
Can we overwater?
It depends on the soil. I mean, if it's a real heavy soil, yeah, you can overwater anything. When you overwater a plant, what you do is make it more susceptible to certain soil-borne funguses that can cause.
I thought you were just drowning them.
Well, yeah, if you saturate the soil to the point, and this is more in the spring, like if the soil's so saturated that the roots can't get oxygen, then the tree can die. But so watering it, you can't really do that very easily.
What can you do to if you have a mucky or a springtime moisture?
Well, what I usually suggest people do is evaluate the site before they plant the tree.
Oh, prevention, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because once it's been there for 2 or 3 years, it becomes more of a job to move it, but it's not impossible to do.
You answered part of his second question about pruning, but what about fertilizing?
Well, fertilizing is done in the springtime, and it's based on the size of the tree. And just a quick way to determine how do you fertilize a young tree, use a balanced fertilizer like a 10-10-10 or a 12-12-12, and you put on 1 cup per inch diameter of the tree.
Okay. So on the surface or?
On the surface, okay. Yeah. You can put it in a ring. There are other ways of fertilizing fruit trees too, which brings me to,
okay,
I have a video on my YouTube channel that talks about fertilizing fruit trees. And I talk about the application on the surface. I talk about using fruit tree spikes. I also talk about using Ross root feeders and
various, you know, I'm expecting you to give me a report that there'll be a rush on your YouTube channel after this airing.
Well, this isn't exactly the ideal time to fertilize a fruit tree, so
okay. Yeah.
But that's right, folks. We want you to know you can go to YouTube and look up Gary Heilig, and that's Gary, G-A-R-Y, and Heilig is H-E-I-L-I-G.
L-I-G. And keep those questions coming, because we want this to become a regular part of our broadcast. We're doing October, so your next opportunity is for the November.
And where do they send the messages? They send it to you, Tom. What is your email?
The email is Tom. It's really simple. My first name, Tom, at the radio station, which is strongtowerradio.org. It's important you put that O-R-G. And in the subject line, you put Garden Guy Question. Mm-hmm. Garden Guy Question dash, and then put the question in there, and I will send that to Gary, or I'll have it here, and we'll ask it in the next month, which will be November or December.
Right, because that's true. Folks, if you have a pertinent question you'd like answered, it might need to be answered right away, so you can forward that to Gary.
We'll patch you through to Gary.
Well, also, if they get a question while they're watching a YouTube video, mm-hmm, you can comment there.
Really?
And people ask me questions all the time, and I do answer them.
All right.
So do it on his YouTube channel. Yep. We learned that new here.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Something new every time on The Garden Guy.
Well, this is September, and so we want to talk about in this first segment about establishing a lawn. This is a great time to establish a lawn in the fall?
It's the best time to establish a lawn between September 15th and October 15th. And the reason why the fall is better is because we're going into a cooler part of the year, which means the seedlings will be under less stress. We're going into a time of the year when we tend to have more moisture, which means you don't have to water as much.
That if you miss a beat, the natural moisture will cover you.
Right, there's dews in the morning and those types of things. And also, we have a lot fewer weed seeds germinating in the fall than we do in the spring. So
Does that make a difference?
Because then you have to deal with weeds. Because,
of course.
When you put down the grass seed, weeds are going to come up also. And we want the grass to get up and become thick so that you don't have as much of a weed problem. But if you sow it in the spring, that's the ideal time for most weeds to germinate also.
Mm-hmm. So
anybody that has a garden knows that they come up in the spring.
Competition, yeah. Yeah.
You don't have to do anything and they come up.
That's exactly right.
Okay, so let's talk about seeding, because there's different ways to seed a lawn.
Well, there are two primary ways that you seed the lawn. One is the traditional way where you use a seeder. The other is called hydro seeding. And hydro seeding is used in larger areas. You've probably seen the Department of Transportation, when they repair roads and things, they will do a hydro seeding. And basically what they have is a mixture of a green dye, the grass seed, and a binder, which is like a newspaper-like material. And it just gets sprayed on. There's a little bit of fertilizer in that mixture.
Isn't there water, too?
Yeah, there's water in it. It's a slurry that they're spraying out. And it allows them to do a very large area. And you can rent machines to do this in a home situation if you want to. But most people either seed the lawn, or if you've built a new house and you want instant lawn, then you can sod.
Now, I've got a question. Even before you put the seed down, how important is the soil that you're seeding into?
Well, the first thing I always tell people they should do is run a soil test. So that they know if they need to put down phosphorus and potassium. You're always going to need nitrogen, but if you need phosphorus and potassium, you want to put that down before you even till up the soil.
So resist the temptation to get those seeds out, to cast those seeds and water it. You need to do your homework.
Right. Another thing you really need to do, too, is get rid of any perennial weeds, like if you have quack grass or there are many, many different perennial weeds, and those should be disposed of also so that you don't have to worry about them after the grass seed is in.
So how do you get rid of the weeds?
Well, that depends on what you're willing to do. Yeah. There are chemical ways of getting rid of them. Glyphosate is a common thing, but that's a real controversial chemical to a lot of people. It's also called Roundup. Mm. And if you don't want to do that, then you can just cover over the area, which is not that practical for large areas, but you can buy large sheets of black plastic and just cover over in an area. It takes about 4 to 6 weeks for it to kill out the grass under there, but it will do the job if you plan ahead.
Now, even with the soil and getting that soil test, you can't get that today and plant that afternoon, can you?
No, it takes, at least in Michigan, the way soil tests are now, you buy what's called a soil test kit. And you can go to the MSU bookstore and
that's order. Online.
That's online, yeah. And
or a campus near you. They have campuses everywhere.
Yeah, there are private companies that will do them too.
Okay.
But if you go the MSU route, you get this kit and everything is included. You put your soil in it and it's a self-mailer back to the university. They send you the email information and then you go to a website. You plug in the numbers from your report and then it tells you what you need to do. So that's something that should be done. Now, if somebody...
What's the lead time on the MSU test?
It takes anywhere from 10 days to 2 weeks. If you just can't wait, then one other option is to use a balanced fertilizer, as I mentioned before, like for the fruit trees, like a 10-10-10 or 12-12-12, and put down what's called 1 actual pound of nitrogen per 1,000 square feet. So since the 10-10-10 is only 10% nitrogen, you need 10 pounds per 1,000 square feet to put down what you need.
So 10 times the normal rate?
No, it's not so much the normal rate. What we're doing is putting down actual nitrogen, and that varies depending on what kind of fertilizer you're using. For instance, if you have urea, which is 46% nitrogen.
It's really concentrated.
It's really concentrated.
You can burn stuff.
You can if you're not careful. But it has no phosphorus and potassium. In order to deliver that 1 pound per 1,000 square feet, you only need 2 pounds of urea because it's 46%.
So this is a little confusing to me. So.
That's why you call your local extension office for help if you don't understand it.
Get help.
Okay. Now, what about buying seed? How long is it good for? Because I know...
I have leftover from last season.
Yeah, well, maybe.
Or what about the spring?
Maybe it's been in a box, sealed up, airtight, for a couple of years. I've got experience with that. Is it still good?
Grass seed does not have a long life.
Shelf life.
So we generally tell people that after a year, you might as well get some new seed. Mm. Certainly, if it's 2 years old, it's probably not going to be very good.
So if you're
going to
buy it, you should put it on.
Buy it fresh. Now, if you bought some this fall and were not able to put it down to the spring, you'll be okay.
Okay.
Now, what I would suggest you do, if you have seed that's coming up on a year age, I would still buy new seed and just mix the old seed in with it. You're going to throw it out anyway. So depending on how it's been stored will determine whether or not it's still good, because seed really needs to be dry and cool. If it's been sitting in a hot garage in high humidity, it's more likely not to be good.
So I'm just trying to process that. This is the way I was thinking even before I heard your answer. I'd put on the regular level of seed, but I would almost like double it up, or I mean, I put the normal suggested the thickness of seed, but I just add the old seed with it as insurance.
Yeah, that's not a problem.
It's now, a strategy.
Normally what we suggest for grass seed is between 3 to 5 pounds per thousand square feet of seed.
Okay.
So you figure out the square footage of your lawn, and then a little simple division will tell you how much seed you actually need. But if you have old seed, there's no reason why you shouldn't put it down, because even if only 10% of it germinated, it's better than just throwing it away.
Right.
So, okay, but so now you're going to seed your lawn. You have to fertilize to help it, don't you?
Well, when you're establishing a lawn, you put down your fertilizer before you till and so you roll the lawn and those types of things, so it's there and ready to go.
You have to till the lawn when you seed it?
That's a yes and a no answer.
Okay. Sounds like I asked a good question.
Well, one of the things that people will do is when they kill off the existing grass, if it's to the point where you need to get rid of it, usually I tell people if you have more than 40% weeds in your lawn, you might as well start over. Well, if, say, somebody sprayed that lawn and killed it, it takes about a month for all that stuff to break down. And a lot of people like to till it all under so that they have a nice smooth surface.
Okay.
Now, the no part of that is you can also establish a lawn by just killing it and then using what's called an overseeder and not disturbing the soil at all. Now, the reason you might disturb it at first is because if you need to change the slope, like around a house or something like that, water will drain away, then you might want to do
that. Or you have, you get those ruts, you get erosion and stuff, so you may need to change the contours.
Right.
Especially when you expose, you have nothing, no roots or anything to hold it, you're going to have increased erosion.
That's right. And if you don't need to do any of that, what you can do is kill the grass out, and then what I do is I mow it down as low as I can mow it. And the reason for that is overseeders don't do well on high dead grass. They're not self-propelled. So you're trying to push it, and you have the resistance from the old grass. And what an overseeder does is it's about the size of a lawnmower, and you put the seed in a hopper in the back, and under it, it has some vertical, they look like saw blades. And they spin, and you pull a little bar back that causes the seed to drop, and then you push this across your soil, and it deposits the seed right into the soil. And the secret to getting a good lawn to germinate is good seed-to-soil contact. So that's one of the reasons why people will, when they till up a lawn, is they'll roll it, put the seed down, and then they'll roll it again so that the seed are in contact with the soil. And an overseeder will allow you to establish a lawn without having to tear everything up.
Okay. We're going to run out of time here in this first segment. Are grubs still a problem in a lawn this time of year?
They're always a problem, aren't they?
Well, right. In September, they can still be feeding on the lawn, and you will start to see damage. And if it's been very dry and you don't have a watered lawn, I guarantee you'll see damage. Now, in a year like this one where it's been dry after it was really wet, most likely you're going to have a problem with European chafers because they like the drier conditions. But if you do have grubs, you should check to find out what's there, because if you put down new seed, they will eat it. And that's not a good idea.
That's right.
Now, what does a chafer look like?
It's kind of hard to describe a beetle on the radio.
Okay.
But
it doesn't look like an ant with wings.
It's a grub, if you know what a grub is.
Yeah, yeah. Those white things that look like a caterpillar.
They're kind of C-shaped. They're curled up. They have legs only right behind the head capsule.
Okay.
And they're about the size of a dime in terms of their overall body size. And they just feed on the roots.
Okay, well, folks, we got to take a quick break, but stay tuned because we have more regarding September with the Garden Guy.
Strong Tower Radio publishes a monthly newsletter about the ministry's progress and listeners' response. Get the free subscription just by calling 231-468-2087. Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
Hi, folks. I'm Jelaine Fenner, and welcome back to Strong Tower Radio today with my co-host,
Tom Majeure,
and our garden guy,
Me, Gary.
Gary Hiley.
We are just plain having fun today.
Yes, this is, we love, especially Tom. Not that I don't love Gary, but Tom is really into the gardening and farming, and he's always got all kinds of topics and questions for Gary. Plus, we've asked you, the listeners, to call in with any questions you may have. And we started the segment up with, was it Bob?
Yes. Oh, actually, we started with Pastor Wes.
Oh, that's right.
He happened to be here, yes. And he asked a question, yeah. And we followed it and forward so now, to
but Bob
Gary.
Had more than one question.
That's right. And his question was about sandy lawns. What can be done with lawns with sandy soil? And we're talking about lawns today,
yeah, so we were just
that's why I held
about
off.
Lawn, yeah.
Well, the problem with the lawn on a sandy soil is sand cannot hold nutrients. Sand cannot hold water. Mm-hmm. So trying to grow a lawn on very sandy conditions is a very difficult thing to do. So if you're going to do it, then I would suggest watering more frequently and fertilizing more frequently. I mean, you can grow sod on concrete.
Mm. On concrete?
On concrete, yeah.
You heard it here.
Scots used to do this little demonstration in their parking lot.
That if you do it right, you can do it on concrete.
It can be done, but of course they had to water frequently and fertilize frequently. When they cut the sod, there's some roots involved. So it's the same thing with sand. Since it's not a good medium in which to grow a lawn, you have to fertilize and water more frequently. If it's a small lawn, and when I say a small lawn, maybe 1,000 square feet or something like that or smaller, then you can top dress over time with organic matter like compost. And as it works its way down to the soil profile.
Explain that just a little bit.
Top dressing is where you take organic matter like compost that's been sifted and then you just put it on the surface of the lawn.
How thin?
They do something called top dressing on golf courses. And how thin? Well, it can be as thick as you want it to be as long as you can still see the grass.
Okay.
Because the grass will grow up through it. Mm-hmm. I probably wouldn't put on more than an inch at a time. And what that will do is those that compost material will release nutrients to the lawn and it will grow better. As the organic matter becomes part of the soil profile, as it works its way down below the blades, then it will be able to hold nutrients and the lawn will get better over time. But that's not real practical for large areas.
Yeah.
So do you do this personally or do people do this commercially at a reasonable cost?
I don't think you see companies top dressing lawns because it would be too expensive. If it was a really sandy soil and somebody was really set on having a nice lawn, you'd be better to start over and bring in at least 3 inches of good quality topsoil. And when I say good quality topsoil, it could be a compost topsoil mix. In our area, in the Lansing area, Granger produces a 50-50 mix, which is 50% municipal compost, 50% topsoil. And then you work that in with the existing soil and you'd be able to grow a better lawn that way.
Well, I know that we have a lake house. And I don't have a lot of parking, so people park, and ruin my grass. Well, this year we just haven't had a lot. So my husband was there one day, and we had some seed. I had some dirt, some black dirt, that I'd bought last year, and it was still left over. I mean, just a little bit.
Was it in bags and stuff?
Yeah, it was in a bag, yeah.
Okay.
And anyways, he thought, well, let's put that out here, and then he put the seed down. Well, within a few days, yes, we had nice new grass growing. He said, boy, I wish I'd put more black dirt down and covered it better.
Done it years ago.
And because he did take seed and fertilize, but where that black dirt is, that grass is growing very nice.
That's overseeding.
And another thing you could do is go to a farmer that might have cow manure. Or you could go to a horse boarding place where they usually have lots of manure. Now, with horses, their digestive system is different, and their manure can have more weed seeds in it. But there's a lot of nutrients and organic matter in their waste, so you could bring that in. You can get rid of the weeds later, get the grass established first, and then take care of the weeds later. but that's another source of organic matter that you could use that would improve that soil.
That begs a question for me, because I have a ready, I hope Chris, my neighbor's listening right now. He's a farmer and he has a spreader, and he came over and put a slurry onto my garden this year. But
the honey wagon came.
The honey wagon came, but can that same thing be used for my 2 acres of lawn?
You could do that. Now,
is there a downside to that?
Well, they usually are spreading fresh manure.
Yeah.
And smell.
Fresh manure has an aroma.
Do I want to do that in the winter?
Well, you can, but it's going to just be on the surface. And if you have a slope, the nutrients can run off into some other area. But even when they're spreading this manure on the fields, it's not very thick. So it would take repeated years of that to make much of a difference.
Well, what if I start this winter?
Well, you can try fall. It. Yeah,
okay.
You can try it.
Okay.
Anytime you can add organic matter, it improves the quality of plants.
Well, we need to talk about harvesting, because it is fall and it's, you know, time to, well, you should have been harvesting some things out of your garden.
It depends on what you're growing.
That's right. And so, well, let's talk about some vegetables. One thing I'm thinking of, it was September, we're getting past sweet corn. Mm-hmm. People should have been already harvesting sweet corn.
Oh, yeah, that usually starts in July.
And how long does that last? You know, how long can you grow sweet corn?
That really varies. I mean, you can still get sweet corn in September if you planted it later.
Mm-hmm. Succession planting.
Right. And normally, though, in our area, we have a sweet corn grower named Prey Farms. And they have some of the best sweet corn I've ever tasted. But they're normally finished by the end of August. Now, this year, they didn't even open until just the last few days. Yeah. So they will probably have corn in the September, as long as the weather holds up.
This has been a different year. Farmers, you know, were not able to get in normally when they wanted to plant.
Right.
And so...
So as long as you have a warm enough weather for the crop to completely ripen, then you can still get sweet corn in the September if you planted it at the right time.
Okay. All right. So
let's talk about squash. I mean, when you talk about harvesting, you've got a whole variety of squash. You've got summer squash. Are we still harvesting summer squash?
That depends on how well the plants were taken care of. For instance, if you have a zucchini plant, they will continue to produce as long as the weather's warm and you keep harvesting. If you were to go away for a while and you had some really large zucchinis develop on the plant, that sends signals to the plant it's time to senesce. I have produced the seed, now I'm done, and it starts to go downhill. But if you want to keep them producing, you have to keep those plants picked.
And
you know,
that's a strategy that could work for you as well, is that if you have too many zucchini.
Oh, yeah. You can just let the big ones sit there and then harvest them for zucchini bread, or just pull the plants up.
Well, that's what I was just thinking, because people always have way too much zucchini.
I did last year. Yeah. I had 5 hills.
And
usually 1 or 2 is enough.
Yeah.
My wife didn't allow me to do more than 2 this year.
But I know, actually, last night somebody had some zucchini, and how big were they? You know, we're just wondering, because they were trying to get rid of all their zucchini, and they were nice size. You know, they weren't these great big things. And so I was thinking, when you said that about if you let it get big, then that tells the plant, okay, you know, we're done, stop.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm thinking, if you are tired of the zucchini, then maybe let it something
grow. Just leave it
grow.
There, yeah. And that's what a lot of people do. Yeah. They just said, forget the zucchini. They watch to see how big it'll get, and that's as far as it goes. Now, the winter squash, like acorn and Hubbard and turban squashes and things like that, what I usually tell people is just leave them there until the frost kills the vines.
So how do you tell which ones you leave? It's the hard squash you can leave till
oh, yeah. They can take a frost.
All of them.
Oh, yeah. All of them. So now what won't take a hard freeze is pumpkins. They don't like that at all. But the hard squash, I normally just leave them there, because the longer you leave them there, the more likely they are to be ready. Because on the outside, they will look ready, like an acorn squash. You cut it open and it's not ready.
I think I made that mistake.
Right. So just wait, because the winter squash are usually not ready until October anyway.
Okay.
So it's best not to do anything with them.
Just leave them alone.
And so once there's a frost, because I understand the squash can take a frost, it's probably best to wait until after a frost anyways.
Yeah, once the vines have started to die, then you know that that's as far as they're going to go.
Now, this might be a September, may still be an October question, but what about runaway vines, squash vines? How much can you trim back there? And they're encroaching on my tomatoes, and I'm starting to get the molds and stuff in my tomatoes because the squash are encroaching. Help.
Oh, you have gotten disease in the tomatoes, whether they're encroaching or not.
Okay.
This is Michigan, man.
So, I mean, how much can I trim back the leaves? What, you know, being a new gardener, I don't want to cut any running vines. I'm going to get more aggressive in future years, but I'm scared. It's like, I don't want one less squash.
The thing is, when you cut back vines, you decrease the amount of sugars that vine is able to make, which will affect the fruit that are on the plant. So they're not really designed to prune.
Okay.
What that tells me is you need to leave more space in your garden.
That's what I was just thinking.
That's a next year thing.
So you need to, because that's the thing about squashes, the vines. You know, it's just like watermelon. I mean, they just grow.
Yeah, and
eternally.
Like I said,
they're indeterminate.
You may have a greater chance of getting diseases on your tomatoes because the squash vines are there and they'll hold more moisture around the plants, which makes a microclimate, which then encourages fungal diseases to grow. But they would have been there anyway. So unless they're causing some other problems, there are fungicides that you can use to keep the diseases at bay and leave the squash vines alone and just think of it as a lesson learned this year.
Okay, thank you. I've learned it.
So let's talk about, I brought up watermelons, you know, and cantaloupe. How do you know when they're ripe?
It's easier to tell when a muskmelon or a cantaloupe is ready than a watermelon. With a muskmelon, a number of different things happen. You can smell the melon. It smells like a muskmelon, whereas a watermelon smell doesn't make any difference at all. Also, with a muskmelon, that green background color tends to turn beige. And as it's getting overripe, the melon will actually detach from the stem. Mm. So when it's ready, it will detach from the stem fairly easily.
It says, I'm done.
Yeah, and of course, like I said, it smells like a melon. And so you have to cut a few. Now, most people aren't used to a true ripe muskmelon because they're softer flesh. They're much sweeter. Whereas the things that we're used to eating in hotels and stores and at buffets are not quite ripe. They're much firmer. They're not very sweet.
For shelf life.
Right. And the shelf life for a ripe melon is going to be a lot shorter. Now, watermelon, there are a number of different things that you look at. One, and it's true with other melons too, is days to harvest is always on the package. So keep a note from the time that you transplant the melon till the time that they say you're going to harvest it, like 75 days, and you can put a little marker on the calendar that I'm getting close at this point. Also, with watermelons, they should be about the size that they're advertised as being. So if it says it's about a 20-pound melon, it should be about 20 pounds. Another thing you can do is turn it over. It should have a light spot. It's either yellowish or white in color. But a really good indicator of whether a watermelon is ready or not is to take your fingernail and push it into the rind. If the melon's not ready, you can push your fingernail into the rind. If the melon is ready, you can't. It won't make much of a dent at all.
I can handle that one. That makes sense to me.
That's a really good indicator.
So I'm trying to visualize. I know when I buy watermelon, I thump it.
Yeah, it's supposed to have a hollow sound to
it.
Yeah. But see, that's so subjective for people. And they'll say,
Do they have an app for that?
You know, maybe somebody thumping. Should develop an app for that.
Oh, one of our listeners, go out there, check out the internet, see if there's an app for that, and then develop one if there isn't.
But that's what I was taught long years ago. And
The thumping act.
Yeah. And when you thump it, and they do sound different.
It's supposed to be a dull, hollow sound.
Right. Dull, hollow.
But now, is it the same? I'm thinking, in the store, these great big, bins. Would it be the same that it's attached to a vine on the ground? Would the sound be the same?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
Because it's on a solid surface when you're doing that thumping.
Okay.
So it's piled on other watermelons. So
okay.
It should be about the same.
Okay, but you just said you take your fingernail and you push it into the rind.
And if it's a ripe melon, you won't be able to do that. It won't leave a mark hardly at all.
So that the rind is very firm,
If it's not quite ready, you can actually
put a little indentation
in it. Yeah.
Okay. That's very interesting. That's good information.
Very good. What about, there are some tomatoes that never really turn green.
There was one other thing.
Sure.
Another indicator is on the vine of a watermelon, it has these little short appendages called tendrils. Probably seen tendrils on grapes where they wrap around things.
Yes.
Well, the tendril closest to the watermelon that's ready, it should be brown.
Oh, okay.
So if it's green, it's not ready.
Oh,
so you use all those things together, but the fingernail thing is a really good one.
Okay.
Okay, you were talking about tomatoes.
About tomatoes. Some are red, and it's obvious what they are. But aren't there green or yellow tomatoes? Aren't there some varieties that really never get red?
There are some varieties of tomatoes that when they're ripe, they're green. Not very many. The majority of them tend to be red. So
you know that when you're planting, if it's going to be a...
Oh, yeah. They tell you that on the package.
Because, tomatoes are green as they're growing, but then they turn red. But then there are some that don't turn red. They stay green.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
They can be kind of a brownish red. They can be orange. They can be yellow. So they're different colors to tomatoes.
Another one of my mistakes this year is keeping the package. So is there better ways to keep the envelope with the information, like a notebook? Would that be help if I put it in a note, maybe stapled it to a page of a notebook, and so I've got all that information?
You could. I have a seed box, and what I do when I sow my seeds, all the empty containers stay in the seed box.
Now, is this box...
It's a plastic sealable box that you pick up at Home Depot or Lowe's.
Oh, it's actually made for that purpose.
No, it's just a storage box.
Oh, you mean like I put my fasteners and tools and stuff?
Whatever, yeah. This box, mine's about this big, which is too small for the number of seats
I have. What size is that?
This is radio. You can't see my hands.
Sorry.
But anyway,
this is not your YouTube channel.
Yeah, it's about 8 inches long, about 4 inches high, and about 3 inches wide.
You just put them
4 inches wide.
One right after another.
I just line them up in there.
Yeah, of course, you probably put all your tomatoes and squashes together. A little bit of...
I do. I put similar plants together. So I'll have all the peppers together. I'll have all the flowers, all the herbs together. Mm-hmm. But even after I use up a whole package, I keep all the packages so that if I need to go back and reference them, I can.
And I can see the benefit of this. And I've learned that here on this program. I need those seed packages because I may or may not want to do those seeds again next year.
That's right.
I like that variety. Mm-hmm. Did I buy it at X store or Y store? Yeah, probably should I went from store to store, little bargain shopping. There's advantage and disadvantage. Some seeds are really expensive and some are bargain priced. And is the bargain a good bargain or not?
The ones that tend to be more expensive are the organic seeds and also the hybrids.
Name brands, too.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going to pay more for Burpee than a smaller company.
All right. Well, folks, we got to take a quick break. But stay tuned because we are not done talking about harvesting and maybe doing planting bulbs. And so just stay tuned. We'll be right back with more with The Garden Guy.
Joe Cruz was given the gift of preaching straight, no-nonsense sermons that would melt your heart and lead you to Calvary. And now you can listen to Joe weekdays at 5:30 a.m. and 3 p.m. right here on Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
Hi, folks. I'm Jillian Fenner, and welcome back to Strong Tower Radio today with my co-host,
Tom Majeure.
And we have the garden guy, Gary Hiley.
That's me.
Yep. And we've been talking about here in September, you know, starting lawns, harvesting. And we're going to talk about more about planting, you know, bulb, fall planting things. But we didn't cover about harvesting fruits like pears, Gary. How do we know when it's time to harvest?
Well, again, if you know the variety that you have, you can look in catalogs and that'll put you in the ballpark. The other thing is with pears, we don't allow them to ripen on the tree. The reason for that is they will develop something called stone cells, and when you
I eat hate pears,
it's really gritty.
That's why I don't like pears is that grittiness.
Yeah, if you pick it at the right time, they can still be sweet and not have that. Mm. So what you should do when you're getting close to the time when that particular variety should be harvested, then you should grab a couple of pears and lift up and twist. Put the pear in the palm of your hand and lift up and twist. And if it comes off easily, then that pear was ready to harvest. Then you set it at room temperature in the house, and then it'll continue the ripening process without developing the stone cells. So, but apples are a little different. There are a number of different things that we look at. Again, the calendar date makes a difference because our first apples are ready, usually late August, and they'll continue into October. So you need to look at a ripening chart for your area to know when you're in the ballpark. And as apples are getting close to being ready, they have the starches inside that are converting to sugars. And so you taste a couple of them. And if they have that starchy flavor or feel in your mouth, and it's, you won't mistake it, then you need to let it sit for a little bit longer. And if it's sweet and you lift on the plant like you did before in terms of putting the fruit in your hand and lift up and twist, it should come off. If you have to pull that apple off, then it's not ready. Or if the stem comes off of the apple when you're trying to harvest, that one's not ready. And you have to realize that all fruit is not ready at the same time. So when you pick an apple tree, it may not be, everything is not going to be ready. Also, color is not a good indication because let's use Empire as an example. It's an apple that's a cross between Red Delicious and Macintosh. If you have a well-pruned tree and you have really nice weather, it'll turn a burgundy red, very dark. But if you have a fairly rainy, cloudy summer, it'll look like a traditional Macintosh, which is kind of reddish and greenish. Or if you don't prune properly and it's toward the middle of the tree, it'll look more like the Macintosh, whereas the ones on the outside will look that dark red burgundy. So you have to use the calendar date, tasting it, trying to pull it off the tree. All of those things will tell you whether or not that apple is ready to pick.
Now, do you have a YouTube talking
on
about
harvesting? Not on that one, but I may get one up there before the season's
okay.
done.
So we just want to mention that, folks. You know, if you want to see, not just listen like on the radio, go to YouTube and type in Gary Hiley, and that's H-E-I-L-I-G. And how many YouTubes do you have?
I have 82 right now.
Okay.
I'm trying to put one
more
up a week. Yeah. I have a list of about 250 that are in production at some level, writing scripts or whatever.
Well, I thought that you should use some temperance and as you're making these. Don't make them all at once, but we shouldn't view them all at once because we shouldn't stay up all night watching YouTube videos.
No,
you're
not supposed to binge watch YouTube videos, but actually YouTube is designed to get you to do just that.
Oh, really?
To go from video to video.
Yeah. So, but there is some great resources on there, and some of the questions that we're asking here will be answered on those YouTube videos.
Yeah. So let's talk about pruning ever-bearing raspberries.
Okay, ever-bearing raspberries, first of all, what they are is a berry that will produce their crop on the primal canes, or the canes that come up the first season. So they'll come up the first season and produce in the fall. And then that primal cane will survive the winter, and then it will produce a second crop on that cane at the time that the summer raspberries produce, which is in July.
So that's just extending from the original growth.
Right. Whereas regular raspberries, what they do is on the primal cane, they grow vegetatively don't produce any fruit in the first season. Then the following season, they'll produce their crop, and then they're done. So if you want just the fall crop, after they produced in the fall, you just cut them all down to the ground and you won't get another crop until the fall. If you want to get the both crops, then after they produce, you don't do any pruning until the spring, and then you would just cut back the part of the cane that has died back. And then you'll get a second smaller crop during the July harvesting period.
Okay, so this, you know, we're in fall. This is a great time to plant bulbs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because you don't plant them in the spring, right?
Well, there's some bulbs that you can plant in the spring. But traditionally, if you want tulips and hyacinths and things like that, you plant them in September is the ideal time. And get them planted because when I was working for Extension, one of the most common questions I would get is, I forgot to plant my bulbs. They're calling in maybe February, mm-hmm. and they said they've been in the garage, and most likely they had exhausted their energy and died. So get them in the ground in September. But the important thing about planting bulbs is a lot of times people think moles will eat them, and moles don't eat them, but field mice will. So it's important, except for daffodils. Daffodil bulbs are poisonous. They'll leave those alone. But many of the others they will eat. So what people will sometimes do is make little cages so that the bulbs can grow out through the cages without allowing the rodents in there. Or you can treat them with a repellent, which is a product called Thiram. It's spelled T-H-I-R-A-M. And it's actually a fungicide, and it's a very bitter-tasting fungicide. And if you were to use that around the bulbs, then the field mice will leave them alone. My daughter planted some bulbs last year, and she just planted the bulbs, and the field mice ate them up.
Well, I had the first year of planting came up, but I saw very poor the second year. So maybe it was soil problems and less than critters.
What kind of bulbs were they?
Tulips, but largely.
Yeah, tulips a lot of times will be replanted every year. But there are some tulips that will come back year after year if something doesn't eat them.
Okay.
Okay, so we're getting into the fall. Well, and we can have a frost in September.
Yeah, and a frost isn't something that I worry so much about. Now, the warm season crops, the ones that are very sensitive to frost, will be taken out with a fairly mild frost. But things like collard greens, they will tend to improve in flavor with a light frost. So I don't get too excited about that. And then once you get a light frost, also a lot of the plants like the root crops will tend to get sweeter, like carrots, because the plant is shipping a lot of sugars down to that taproot for the winter months. So frost can be a good thing too.
When it comes to those summer crops that are sensitive to frosting, how long can you fight this battle against the frost? Rule of thumb.
Well, you can protect plants against frost. Now, there's a difference between a frost and a freeze.
Okay.
And a frost, you can put something over top of the plants, and the frost doesn't develop on your plants. And basically what a frost is, you have all these little pieces of dust on the surface of the leaf, and it gets cold enough for ice crystals to form on those little dust particles. But it doesn't get cold enough to freeze the internal portions of the cells, what we call the cytoplasm. And when it gets cold enough and the cell actually freezes, we know that liquids expand when they freeze and they rupture the cells, and that's why the plant dies. And that's what we call a freeze.
Okay. Now, what about also this time of year, good to be planting trees in the fall?
Yeah, it's not the best time for availability, but a lot of nurseries and garden centers don't want to keep that stuff during the winter months. So they want to sell them, and they'll sell them at big discounts, 50% off or more. And fall is a great time to put the trees in because there'll be less stress. The weather's getting cooler, you're getting more rain, and so you can pick up some real deals. So fall planting of trees is a good thing.
Well, you know, the box stores, those who aren't nurseries, they will sell them all out in the spring. So where do I find these clearance trees?
Well, if you go to Lowe's right now, they have them.
Really?
Okay. I always watch at the different places. They don't sell out everything. So there's usually some things left there, and they'll discount them. The thing that I want to know is, have they been taking care of them? And you can tell whether or not the leaves around the edges are starting to turn brown. That's an indication that they weren't watered like they should have been. And
so there's going to be a rush on Lowe's after this program, right?
Well, Lowe's, Menards, Home Depot, they all have some left over. And like I said, some of the garden centers in your local area will have some trees left over too.
And they really don't want to keep them. I mean, they need to sell them, right?
It's going to be a loss.
You don't make money with something just sitting on a lot. So But fall is a good time to plant trees.
Mm-hmm. What about I'm getting a greenhouse and I'm putting it up. How do I use the greenhouse to extend? Now, I didn't plan it this fall because I built it this summer. How can I use this greenhouse to extend my season?
Well, a greenhouse is a season extender because during, let's say, an October day where it might be 50 degrees outside, if your greenhouse is covered and the doors are closed, it'll be 90 degrees inside. Mm. So you can continue to get produce into October, November, and depending on the weather, maybe even December, if the weather's not too cool. Now, there are certain cool season crops like spinach and lettuce and things of that sort, certain herbs that you can grow right up into December. And once it gets just too cold at night, then you can't do anything unless you have heating.
So my wife is saying, well, that greenhouse, maybe the kids can come over after school starts in late August and do something in the greenhouse. What do you recommend she do?
Yeah, in August in the greenhouse is like a sauna.
Okay.
Now, of course,
plants want a sauna?
Not too many.
Okay.
You need to make sure you have water out there because things will dry out very quickly. But in August, you can put in things like lettuce and spinach and collards and various types of greens, and they will grow into the fall. So you can still produce quite a bit inside that greenhouse, but I wouldn't suggest planting peppers and tomatoes and those types of things unless you wanted to give them supplemental lighting and heat. So
it's basically going to be greens.
Yeah. And MSU
any root crops, we put some cold crops? Your broccolis and stuff, or is it still too warm?
Well, broccoli can grow under cool conditions, but you have to understand that a lot of the things that you're growing during the summer are what we call long day plants, which means they need long days and long periods of sunlight and short periods of darkness in order for them to produce fruit. So growing broccoli probably isn't going to work.
Okay.
Unless you wanted to, give it extra lighting and fool it into thinking it's summer and giving it the heat that it needs. So
that's the advantage of having a greenhouse. You can start earlier.
That's
right. And you can extend the growing season longer.
Well, you'll be able to start growing
on both
things.
Ends.
That's right. You'll be able to start growing things as early as February.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
But again, it'll be the cooler season crops.
Right. Okay, well, let's talk about perennials. Now, I've got, some flowers. How do you then divide them without bothering the ones you want to leave and moving some more to another area?
Well, first thing, the reason why we divide perennials is they start to get too big for their space. Mm-hmm. It might be a hosta or whatever the case may be. And some perennials, they'll actually start to die out if they're not divided. Mm-hmm. The center may start to die out. You'll see that in ornamental grasses, for instance. So September is a great time to divide those plants. A lot of garden clubs will have perennial plant exchanges, so the members will give each other plants. And so once you divide them up, then you just plant back a portion into the area. And some people will actually work a little organic matter into the soil when they do that to improve the soil, and the plants grow very well.
It's kind of fill in that void of what you took out?
No, it's not so much that. You're just trying to enrich the soil. Some people will put peat moss in or a potting soil, leftover potting soil, or whatever the case may be. And then the other thing you can do is move those other plants somewhere else in the yard give them to friends or whatever.
It's a fun time. You can be generous.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you can literally redesign your beds and mm-hmm. stuff.
And some people will start a whole new perennial garden in the fall. I'll be doing that this year at my house. I started a lot of perennials from seed, and I bought some perennials, and so I'll be putting that all together this fall.
You brought up a term that people don't hear that much. You know, people of society and stuff used to join the garden club. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do they still exist?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Lots of garden clubs.
Cadillac has a garden club.
Really?
Yes.
Okay,
you
sign me up.
That.
Sign me up.
Oh, okay.
I'll be there next
garden
month.
Clubs are still alive and well all over the country.
There's wonder. I've heard my sister talks about garden clubs and stuff. And what a wonderful reason. You have like-minded people who can help each other and love to do it.
So would people go find out if there's a garden club in their area?
Oh, if you just go on to the internet, because mm-hmm. there are specialty garden clubs too. There might be hosta societies mm-hmm. or rose societies, and most of them have websites. So if I wanted to know what type of garden clubs are in Michigan, I just Google it.
Okay.
They'll tell you about garden clubs all over the place.
Okay. What about wildflowers? You know, because you've got this area that you're not really going to grow anything, but you'd like to just have, it's a perennial, wildflowers. How do you go about getting that area taken care of?
Well, wildflowers are usually started from seed, and most of the time they're started in the spring.
Okay.
I guess you could probably sow some wildflowers in the fall if you can get the seed.
Okay, all right. But there again, I'm thinking of, you know, a place where you might want some. I've even gone along the side of the highway where they've got wild daisies growing and dug them up and brought them and transplanted them.
Is that legal?
I don't know, but I did it.
unless it's a protected plant, then you're probably going to be okay, because say like a New England aster, certain years you see those little purple flowers all along mm-hmm. the highway. Another option would be is just to wait for them to produce their seed and collect the seed. Collect the seed from a superior looking plant mm-hmm. and grow it from seed.
Okay. Well, folks, our time has flown by like it always does with Gary. He's got so much information. And we want to mention again about his YouTube channel, because he's got 82 YouTubes out there where you can actually listen to him, see him, and see demonstrating what is going on.
And you can meet Gary.
Yes, that's right.
And I have a lot of interesting things I'll be making over the winter, too. I'm going to do a series on different soil amendments like silica, biochar, and a number of other things that are out there to see if they really do anything.
Okay.
So this is a thing that if you wake up and can't go to sleep in the middle of the night, you can get up and watch the Gary's YouTube channel.
Hey, whatever floats your boat.
Okay. So that's Gary Heilig, and the last name is H-E-I-L-I-G. And check him out. And so we hope that this has been educational, and if you have any questions, send Tom an email. It's tom@strongtowerradio.org, and he will get a hold of Gary. If you have a question, you can send it to him. He can get home right away, or best, go to the YouTube channel, and you can give Gary a message right there, and he will get back with you.
Well, thanks so much, Jelaine, and thank you, Gary.
You're welcome.
Bye, folks.
Bye.